Love Osho podcast brings you the real stories of the people whose lives have been inspired and transformed by Osho. We explore why thousands of people are falling in love with Osho and where to find them. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the Love Osho podcast. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Swami Anand Vikrant. Vikrant took sannyas in 1988 and is a counselor and psychotherapist, trained at the Northern Illinois University, USA and Osho Multiversity, Pune, India. Vikrant is a member of the Association for Humanistic Psychology, Transpersonal Psychology and the Association for Body Psychotherapy. Vikrant is the author of 6 books and numerous articles on the awakening of consciousness and personal development. Vikrant has taught in various psychology programs, including the Department of Counseling, Adult and Health Education and Northern Illinois University, USA. He's a former research consultant on active meditations in Sydney, Australia, and has been training therapists and facilitators in humanistic transpersonal psychology for more than 20 years. Vikrant is the founder of the Experiential Center for Human Development and creator of the Returning to the Source workshops, Biodynamic Structural Massage, and Somatic Emotional Processing. Vikrant, I'm so excited to have you on the show and really look forward to discussing with you a very important topic, which has been not given the right attention for some reason. We will talk about Osho's influence on therapy and Western psychology and see how the leading figures of the humanistic transpersonal movement have been directly or indirectly influenced by Osho. Unfortunately, Osho's contribution to present-day psychology has not been acknowledged, so I'm really, really happy to discuss all of this with you. Before we jump into it, into the main topic, I'd like to start by asking you how you came across Osho.
Okay. First of all, thank you, Swaram, for having me in your show. It's an honor and a pleasure for me to be talking to you and to be able to share with your audience these subjects. Well, I came across Osho when I was 17 years old. This is over 36 years ago. And I was by then a normal Chilean boy that belonged to a Catholic grassroots community. And within that group, the person who was leading this group became interested in Gestalt therapy and humanistic psychology. Through that, he came to participate in some marathons led by sannyasins. And then his life was transformed, although he was a very serious Catholic. And being a social worker, he decided to train to do this kind of work, and he brought it to the Christian community, the Catholic community. So I did a whole night marathon with Osho meditations in this Christian Catholic group, and that changed my life. It was an experience that of myself that I never had before, and I just could never go back. I mean, my life was changed from that moment forever. I mean, what I discovered, or the depth that I got in touch with about myself, was something that I didn't even know that existed in me. And I had never had that experience with myself. And then my search began. And 2 years later, I went to the university to another town, and I came back to my city, Santiago. And I joined another therapy group that was going to last for around a year. And that was basically also led by sannyasins, and we used Osho meditations. And then, and from then on, it just never stopped. I became a seeker, I became a sannyasin. I went to live in a sannyas commune that existed at that time in Chile, we're talking about 1988. And since then, I devoted my life completely to be a seeker, a sannyasin, and that's how things started for me.
Amazing. Now, it's very interesting to hear that Osho was brought into a Christian context, perhaps
And it happened many times. The chaplain of the of Cambridge, I think, University, who was actually a priest, was a sannyasin in the 70s.
Oh, amazing. Okay, yeah. That's great. So you mentioned 1988. So, of course, Osho was still in the body.
Yes, I understand
from our previous conversations that you did not meet Osho in the body, but you had some letter exchanges.
Tell us about that. At that time, I mean, you have to understand this was pre-internet era, so there were no emails, so everything was done in letters. So I used to write to him about my conflicts and my doubts and basically requesting support in my process, and kindly I always got a response. I assume these letters somehow was shown to Osho, and he would give an answer to his secretary, and that would be sent back to me. I assume, because I think the questions that I had were somehow more complicated than something that could have been just answered by somebody at the office, you know, like, I don't know. There were not answers like follow your heart or do what it feels right for you or things like that many times people got that were just written by the management, you know. So I had a feeling of a strong connection with him, despite the fact that I was never physically with him. My first time that I went to Pune was in 1995. He had been dead already for 5 years. But my feeling and the way it felt for me was I was in darshan. I mean, I was in connection with him, in a connection that was, for me, and it still is, beyond time and space. I mean, it has nothing to do with whether I was physically there with him, but I felt with him, or I felt him with me.
Now you piqued my curiosity on what kind of answers Osho gave you, if you want to share. I'm sure it's something very personal, but was there something like that?
I mean, there was something that was very curious. I asked him when he thought he would leave his body, because I wanted to go and see him. And I was 20 years old then, and I didn't have enough money to support myself. And he said, I am not planning to leave my body before 2017. So I think he was a bit short with the, he didn't know then that he had been poisoned by the American government. So he thought he would live until 2017. And that was something that always, it sticked in my mind, because when he left his body in 1990, it was a shock for me. I mean, I was devastated. The communication wasn't so easy at that time between meditation centers, communes, and Pune, because you had several weeks, sometimes months, of communication when you would send a letter and it would come back. So I didn't know that he was so sick, and so I was devastated when I knew that he had passed. So and I felt angry, because he told me that he wasn't going to leave his body before 2017. And I thought, well, I have enough time to get my life together, save some money and go be with him, you know? And it just never happened like that.
Wow, I've got shivers, actually. You know, I never heard this before. I mean, it's shocking. Yeah. So many people would have had a chance to meet him, including me, you know, now I get.
I mean, probably if he would have been, I would be in Pune now if he would be there, you know? Absolutely. Perhaps doing what most people did back then, you know, work a little bit in Europe, you know, waitressing or whatever, and then go back to stay 6 months in Pune.
Absolutely. Osho was such a magnet, and still is.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have got such a huge topic to cover. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm so excited, and it's very, very crucial and important. So let's get into it. And let's talk a little bit about... I mean, you wrote a whole book on this topic, on Osho's influence on Western psychology, which is based on 10 years of research, which includes a lot of interviews with the protagonists and pioneers of the human potential movement, as well as sannyasins, of course, and the therapists in the Osho commune. That's a huge amount of work. So perhaps let's start with what motivated you to embark on such an enormous project.
Well, as I was telling you before, I was studying then in the United States. This was, I think, at the end of 1994. One of the things that I was encountering back then was the fact that many of the leading figures of the human potential movement and humanistic psychology that I was hearing about were names that I recognize from the Darshan Diaries. You know, and I said, but this guy was with Osho. And this other guy was with Osho, and I heard this name. I know these guys. So I was seeing that all these leading figures had somehow at some point been influenced by Osho, or they stayed with him till the very end. And I was realizing that this wasn't being acknowledged anywhere. So I decided to dig deeper, so to speak. So I decided, okay, so what if I reconstruct the story? How did this guy get to Osho? And in which way the meeting between East and West of psychotherapy and meditation changed what we understood then as transpersonal psychology? So I decided to tell the story, basically. There was no internet back then, so if you wanted to do any sort of research, you had to go either to the source or to the libraries, you know? So I spent weeks in the Congress Library in the United States looking at old magazine and catalogs and books, and then I decided to travel around and interview the people around the world that somehow were part of the story. It was not easy to reconstruct how the human potential movement and humanistic psychology got to Europe, because there was no then written information about it. And so that's how it started. I was also in Pune looking at old Darshan diaries that were not available because they were out of print, looking for these people and searching for the conversations that they had with Osho, and how was this exchange. And all that became this book, which basically not only is a book that speaks, let's say, from an intellectual point of view, how this happened, but is the human stories of these guys, of their doubts, of their search, of their conversations with Osho, of their experiments there in Pune, of their experiments before, and how all this, you know, became a huge foundation of what today we call humanistic transpersonal psychology. And it is so much so that this book is used in several universities in Latin America to teach humanistic psychology. That's how it all started.
Yeah, that's really impressive. And I wish, my only wish here is that your book will be translated in English and other languages, and perhaps been adopted in other universities in Europe and America and so on and so forth, because, you know, there is real value, and it's historical, it's evidence-based, it's factual. So let's start from the beginning. So it's basically a story of how the leaders and pioneers of the human potential movement came to Osho.
Yes.
So give us a little bit of context of the state of affair of the human potential movement in the 60s and 70s, exactly when Osho started these activities, and then to understand why and how these guys then went to Osho.
Well, I think it all started at the end of the 1950s with Abraham Maslow, who had been influenced by Kurt Goldstein and was interested in studying normal people, you know, because we have Freudian psychology that was basically based on psychopathology. I mean, the whole theory of the human psyche developed by Freud was based on studying people who couldn't quite function socially. And Maslow considered this a bit limiting, and also the other line of important, you know, school of psychology, which was behaviorism, he considered them a bit shallow, you know, and just focus on trying to modify behavior and not trying to find out about the causes behind behavior. So Maslow decided to study and see what was the way that people motivated to growth. So he decided to study normal people, let's say normal neurotics, not people who had serious psychiatric pathologies. And from there, in the United States originally, at the beginning of the 1960s, people began to experiment and to wonder in which way we could use psychological, let's say, technology, not only to cure dysfunctional behavior, but to use it as a way to explore human development, to explore human growth. And from there, especially in the 1962 or 1963, the first growth center in the world appeared in the West Coast of the United States, the Esalen Institute. And the Esalen Institute was the place where basically humanistic psychology moved from being a theoretical approach, trying to understand human psyche or human motivation, to a practical way of exploring it, you know? So things which are very common for us, like group work or workshops or seminars, it didn't exist before. So it was the first time in human history where people went to psychologists or to the psychological field, not to cure their neurosis or their dysfunctional behavior, but to explore the possibility of what more was possible for me. So people take off their ties, take off their shoes, you know, got rid of the chairs, decided to sit in cushions on the floor and to explore what all these theoretical people were talking about. Abraham Maslow, Huxley, Carl Rogers, Fritz Perls, Alexander Lowen, Will Schutz, Bernard Gunther, all these people decided to create an experiential psychology. And they decided to work not only with the intellect, and they moved away from the conversational therapy into an experiential therapy. And even they started to get rid of the word therapy because it had a connotation of something not working, and decided to call this work. So people didn't talk about going to therapy, but to work on yourself. You know, Fritz Perls, the creator of Gestalt therapy, coined the word workshop instead of therapy group, you know, workshop. You know, we're going to work on the workshop. So trying to take the psychological work away from psychiatrists and from the mainstream medical model into a personal development model. And this created an explosion in the United States first, in the late 60s, early 70s, and then this was carried to Europe and to the second, growth center in the world, which was Quaesitor Growth Center, which was started by Paul Lowe and Patricia Lowe, both whom later became sannyasins, and they were leading therapists in the Osho world as Tirtha and Poonam. And then from Quaesitor, it started to spread all over Europe. So we had the SIST Centrum in Germany. We had Center in Netherlands, and et cetera, et cetera. And so all these people were working with experiential psychology and working with the possibilities of expanding consciousness that didn't only mean to resolve your inner conflicts, but also the possibilities of growth, of expanding your sensitivity, of working on your childhood issues, on working on the way you relate to other people, working with the body and working with the emotions. And what happened to them is that they started to see, let's say, the ceiling of this approach. You know, they had worked on their bodies, they had worked on their childhood, they had worked on their sexualities, on their unresolved traumas, and they learned to be more honest, spontaneous, to relate to each other. And then what else was possible? And then they turned to the writings from the East. They turned to Advaita Vedanta, to Hinduism, to Buddhism, looking for what more was possible in the realm of consciousness. And in that search, some people joined, you know, people, sects like the Hare Krishna, or some people turned Hinduist or Buddhist, but some people also were looking for a living master. And then Richard Alpert, Ram Dass, I don't know if you know his name, the author of Here and Now, was the first Western psychologist who came back to the United States with a new name, who had met his master in the Himalayas, Baba Neem Karoli. And this was a huge inspiration for a lot of people to travel east to find, you know, a living master. And then there was a book going around in London around that time called The Dynamics of Meditation, which was a book authored by Osho, you know, taken from one of his talks. And many of the people who were involved in the growth centers in London, in Quaesitor Growth Center, in Community, Michael Barnett, Paul Lowe, Alan Lowen, who later became Tirtha, Sumendra, and Rajen, were interested. And this was a book that was read around this circle. So these guys decided to travel east and go check this guy out. And they got there and they were stunned. I mean, when Paul Lowe or Michael Barnett got for the first time to be with Osho, they couldn't believe what they were seeing. You know, there was this guy that was way beyond all these people that they knew, way beyond Perls, way beyond Carl Rogers, way beyond Will Schutz, the creator of the encounter groups. And they decided to stay. So that's how it happened. And at that time, this was in Mumbai. It was in the early days. It was before Pune. So they went there and they found what they had been looking for. And this is one important point, I think. They were most appealed by dynamic meditation because it was the only technique that didn't somehow teach repression or to sit on your own neurosis. But it was very, let's say, very in tune with the humanistic psychology movement, with the human potential movement, which was first, if you want to find the inner peace, you need to face your own neurosis. You need to go through your own turmoil and throw it out.
Okay, well, that's a beautiful overview of how the human potential movement started in essentially Esalen, we can say. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned some big names, Carl Rogers, Fritz Perls, and Aldous Huxley, the creme of the creme. And then it came to Europe via London and then spread through Germany, Holland, and perhaps other countries. Mm-hmm. And then they hit the bottom line where the ceiling, as you said, you know, they were looking for the transcendental element, you know, what is beyond therapy. They start searching towards the East, and then they came across Osho, and Osho was way beyond any of the other gurus or masters, as well as any of the other therapies they could find in the West.
Yes.
So I think it's interesting to maybe a little bit go deeper into this, highlighting how these highly intellectual people coming out of the best universities in America and Europe, they were attracted to an Indian man who never came out of his country up to that point. We're looking at the early 70s, and they completely fell totally in love and they were in awe. So what was the appeal? What did these people find in Osho that they were so blown away?
I think there were several factors. First, Osho was an educated man. He wasn't some sort of Indian sadhu coming out of some small Indian village who basically had a beautiful smile and shiny eyes. And he was somebody who could actually talk with any property about humanistic psychology, about psychoanalysis, about Western philosophy, because he was an educated man. He was a well-read man. I'm not saying necessarily that was essential to his message, but it was essential to who he was. He wasn't some backgatter Indian guru. This guy was also, apart from being an enlightened master, was a giant intellectual. I mean, he was incredibly well-read with the vast amount of knowledge and the understanding that he had of human psyche. And the approach to human psyche was very different from all the other Indian gurus. First, he wasn't for repressing sexuality, and this was a big issue. Most of the Western who went to India, one of the first things they encountered was this thing of first separating men and women. Indian ashram, traditional ashram, separated men and women. So sexual encounter was forbidden, celibacy was highlighted, and it was a way. So if you wanted to become a disciple, if you wanted to have a spiritual path, the first thing that you had to give up was sex and worldly pleasure. And then we had this guy who was not only not advising to give up sex, but it was insistingly reminding these people that sex was natural, that sex was a way to enlightenment, and that they didn't have to renounce any worldly pleasure, and that spirituality and materialism could go hand in hand. And this was new. I mean, for us today, with all the access to information that we have, it's not a big deal. But at the end of the 1960s, to find a man, an Indian man, who was the least Indian man that you can find in the world, you know, in this sense, advocating a holistic approach to growth. And that later, when the Pune Ashram was established in 1974, not only it had an holistic approach to growth, but he said, hey, let's bring all these therapies here. Let's have groups in the ashram. That had never happened before and never happened again. No other Indian ashram ever included therapy and psychotherapy and personal growth as part of their programs. And there was even a time when the Pune Ashram was called Esalen East. That was like the nickname that it was known in the psychological world. And so we had this man that was way beyond they had ever seen. And he was also not only was an intellectual, which he was, but he was a master. So he was offering an experiment. He was offering these people not only an intellectual understanding of things like what Krishnamurti did, which was beautiful. You know, if you look at Krishnamurti's work, it's fantastic, wonderful. But he didn't build any bridges between himself and where he was and where the people was. So he was only just surrounded by intellectual, but Osho decided to create an experiment to say, hey, look, I've discovered this in myself, and I'm going to create an experiment for you to discover it on yourself. And this experiment is called Sannyas. We're going to play a game. I'm going to play the game that I'm going to be the guru, the master, the teacher, and you're going to be the disciple. And you're going to do things according to the way I tell you to do it, because what you consider is your way is not really your way, but it's a way of your mother, of your father, of your society. So this game is about, instead of you judging reality through yourself and your own social conditioning, you do it through me. Let me be the deciding factor. Surrender to me, which was the motto in the early 70s, surrender to me and I will transform you. And that was the game. And that game was a multidimensional game. First, you had to change your clothes. You know, you have to dress in orange, then red, then purple, pink, or whatever. You know, you had to wear a mala, you know, with a picture of a guy hanging on your chest. I mean, think about it, what it was for the first intellectuals or the first figures. I'm thinking of Amitabh, for instance, who used to lead the Tao group, Robert Birnbaum. He was a very well-respected psychologist in California and came back from India. You know, he had his own practice, had been the disciple of Carl Rogers and Eric Berning from Transactional Analysis. And he comes back dressed in an orange robe with a mala, and he goes to his practice to treat his patients, you know, dressed like this. And I remember him telling me, and I was as self-conscious about myself and ashamed as the disturbed people that I was working with, you know? So Osho grabbed all these guys and put them in this game to learn about themselves. And they had to face this game, you know? And they had to go into the world dressed, quote unquote, as clowns, you know? And forced to stand on their own feet and forced to look at the way they conceived themselves through their masks. And I think it was brilliant. I mean, what he did for all these people and the experiment he created, this multidimensional experiment, it was nothing like they had ever seen before. And then, of course, we had the whole other subject of when the group started and everything that began from there.
There are so many points that I want to explore more in details. Yes. And let's start with the Esalen. You mentioned that Pune was called the Esalen of the East. And as far as I'm aware, at some point, the co-founder of Esalen arrived to Pune.
Yes, Dick Price.
How did it go? Tell us about that.
Well, I interviewed several people about it, including who was the leader of the encounter group where he was sent. Paul Lowe, Swami Ananda Tirtha, back then, who was like Osho's right-hand man, or he was considered like this, one of the English channels, as they were called. Well, the thing is, so I think we need to backtrack a little bit to see. Bernard Gunther, who was a famous best-selling author, acclaimed in the United States because of his humanistic psychology books. He was the author of Sense Relaxation Below the Mind, What to Do Till the Messiah Come, etc., etc. This was the guy who brought Fritz Perls to Essel and the creator of Gestalt Therapy. And he was into something called sensory awareness that was developed by Charlotte Selve. And basically to have sort of meditative experiences with things. It was a technique to open your sensitivity. And he came to Pune in 1976 and became a sannyasin. And he brought back to Esalen, basically Osho's understanding and Osho's way. And people started to read his books, you know, and there were many sannyasins that were very strongly connected with Esalen. And the creators of Quercetal Growth Center in England, Paul Lowe and Patricia Lowe, they were very close friends of Mike Murphy and Richard Price. So all these people were somehow exchanging, you know, from one country to another. So the thing is that Richard Price took sannyas by mail, and he got the name Vit Govind. And he and his wife took sannyas, actually. And then he decided in 1977 to go to check Pune, you know. So he came and sat in front of Osho, you know, and he was a very honest, vulnerable man. And he was crying in front of Osho, weeping, you know. I have the exact transcription of the conversation, you know. And at some point of the exchange between him and Osho, Osho said, Esalen has to become my place. And Richard Price says, it's yours. This would have been a pivotal moment, you know, in the history of how this was going. So then Richard Price, Osho asked him if he wanted to lead some groups at the ashram. And he led, I think, a Gestalt group. And also he participated in the meditation camps that then used to last for 3 days, I think. And one thing that was, I would say, very common was that people would be sent to the encounter group, especially if they were therapists or famous people from the West. You know, they had to do encounter with Tirtha, which, if people who are listening to the story, they don't know, it was the most infamous group in the ashram. Back then, it was a 7-day group. Of course, the door was open and you could leave anyway, anytime you wanted. But usually Osho would send people at that time to the group. So it wasn't so easy to just say, well, just didn't like, I'm going to do something else. I'm going to do Rolfing instead. You know, you had been sent by Osho. So somehow you figured it was part of your process to do this. And the thing is that at that time was the most extreme group. It was the most confrontational group in the ashram. You were basically shattered in your ego and your defenses. And one thing that was the scariest part, it was that physical violence was permitted in the group. If you had unresolved issues with some of the other participants, you could act them out physically. And it was advertised as a known limit group. Years later, when I interviewed Tirtha Polo, he told me, yeah, it was advertised as a non-limit group. But actually, he was always checking that things didn't go way out of control, although allowing people to live their sexuality, their repressed emotion, and their physical violence. So the thing is, I mean, as the story goes, and this is the story that Dick Price told then, going back to Esalen. He didn't like the violence in the group. He was familiar with encounter groups because basically they almost came out of Esalen. And the founder of encounter groups, Will Schutz, also was in Pune. And he went into the group room when he visited of the encounter group, but he didn't stay because he was afraid to get beaten up. So the thing is, he didn't like the fact that you were allowed to act out your suppressed violence. And he didn't like it at all. And he left the ashram and wrote a letter to the Time magazine denouncing basically what he didn't like about the way the encounter group was conducted. He liked Osho's approach. He liked his lectures, but he didn't like the violence in the groups. So, and he left not very happily, let's say. You know, he left in a hurry. He didn't say goodbye to Osho and all this thing. Well, a year later, I interviewed Paul Lowe Tirtha about what happened in that group. And he added an element that I didn't know before, and it was never discussed, or at least Dick Price never discussed it. And he said that he wasn't honest. You know, he wasn't honest in the group. And people reacted to that, you know, which was what the group was about. If you were trying to defend yourself or hide behind masks, people would confront you. And not only the group leader, you know, but the participants will reflect back to you the fact that you were being phony or that you were hiding or whatever. And that was basically the trigger. I mean, of course, the violence of the group or this could have been also another factor. But the basic thing is that he was the co-founder of the Esalen Institute, you know. And he was called on his not being honest, you know, and he not only in his not being transparent, you know, and he couldn't deal with that and run away.
I see.
That's the story.
Fascinating. And thanks for revealing all the details. And okay. What comes to mind listening to your story is that Encounter Groups was not created in Pune by Osho, was kind of taken from Esalen, as you said. And I believe that maybe the question to you, was the encounter group already including confrontation, or this
yes.
element of confrontation came yeah. in Pune because with Osho, things were allowed, encouraged to be expressed even more. So if that's the case, then the kind of the reason why he didn't like the encounter group doesn't stand, because, you know, that's the whole point of encounter group, right?
Yes. Well, encounter groups were created, I mean, there are two basic founders, Carl Rogers, which has what was called encounter groups, and then Will Schutz, who in Esalen developed what was called the open encounter group. Tirtha, Paul Lowe, trained with Will Schutz. So the kind of encounter that he was using was much more active than Carl Rogers' encounter group. And that meant that people were encouraged to act out their repressed feelings. And there were physical fights, but it was always very controlled, you know. And if things got a little bit too much heated, people were given padded things to hit each other with or whatever, or hit each other with pillows. And in Pune with Osho, as you, I imagine by now you well know, Osho always used to like to take the things further, you know, the next step. So what was done in Pune is that there was no limit. I mean, you could do whatever you wanted, basically. And actually, one of the instructions at the beginning of the group was to lift out all your socialized repressive behavior. That was the best. So it was like, take away everything that society has imposed over you and allow yourself to be who, whatever you are in this moment. And of course, the first things that came out was sex and violence, and you have to understand that we're talking also about baby boomer, you know, from the Europe and the United States, who basically were coming out of the Vietnam War. I mean, these people were boiling with violence. And what Osho did was to create this experience where people could act this out in a protected environment. Of course, sometimes it got a bit out of hand, but not as out of hand as the yellow press would like it to think, that people got killed or raped. No one got ever killed and no one was ever raped in the group. But yeah, people sometimes got, you know, some broken arms and things like that. But it was not the common thing. It was more the exception. People were encouraged to physically meet each other in all the levels that were possible. And this was so, I think, until 1980. And from there, Osho said, okay, it's done its job. No more physical violence. Throw your anger to pillows. But there was
before physical confrontation. It was part of the encounter group, but here it was more extreme. Let's put it this way, you know. And also there's a group, a Darshan diary called "Get Out of Your Way," where Osho explains in very profound detail why he thought that physical violence had to be allowed. Because there had to be no limits. You had to go to a place where you could encounter your biggest fear, which was basically sexuality and your own repressed violence, you know. And the idea was that you would act this out, throw it out, so basically you could be free from it, you know. So instead of having fantasies about beating people up, you could live it in that environment and see what happens and who you were behind all that.
I mean, it's just incredible to imagine such experiment, you know, a place where you have this man who had such deep understanding of human mind and psyche, creating an environment where people are allowed to do that, to act that, to express that. And nowadays, we kind of take it for granted in a way, because we live in a much more freer society, especially from a sexual point of view. As you mentioned, within that context, what these people have gone through is almost the legacy that we have nowadays as human beings living in our society is the result of the risks taken by those people there. And thanks to Osho, who allowed that experiment to happen. And I think this is not really discussed, whereas the yellow papers, as you say, they're just the yellow journalism. They want to, you know, pick on the scandals and they completely miss the big picture and the context and the reason why that was happening and the benefits of it.
Yeah. And I think it was risky, but Osho's way was risky. I mean, the people who came to him in the early 70s and that basically surrendered to him, it was risky because you could be cheated. You know, we in the West, we are so afraid of letting go. We are so afraid of surrendering. Imagine what it was to surrender to a man, you know, and would say, okay, now do things according to what I tell you to do so that you can find your real way. It's not about doing what I tell you. It's about using that as an experiment to let go or get rid of whatever you consider your way, which is basically your conditioned way. And it required a huge courage. And then you go back to the West dressed as a clown, you know, in an orange robe. You know, imagine what that meant for all these people. I think at that time, to be a sannyasin required a huge courage. I mean, you had to have the guts to do that. Nowadays, it's much easier because you can be a closet sannyasin. You have a spiritual name. Perhaps every other guy in the spiritual alternative world has a spiritual name, no problem. But back in the 70s, it was a completely different story. In the early 80s, it was a completely different story. And Osho was willing to experiment and was willing to risk and was willing to take all these people into the next level. You know, and I think what he did was fantastic. I mean, to tell you the truth, I mean, I'm still in awe of the courage that Osho had, and I'm still in awe in how he managed to create a coherent experiment that was a game, and that it was presented as a game and as a risky game. And there were a lot of people who would go to Osho and say, oh, yes, I love your work and I love what you do, but I don't want to change really my name. You know, I got this work at home and I don't really want to dress in red. What can I do? And Osho said, nothing. Either you dressed in red, you change your name, or there was nothing we can do. There was no compromise there. I loved it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree with you. To be a sannyasin in those days, it was a very, very courageous choice. You know, we're interviewing lots of sannyasins, and sometimes we hear stories which are so hilarious. You know, the guy who went into an investment bank in New York in Wall Street dressed in orange, or another sannyasin Subhuti who went into the Houses of Parliament with his mala and got people, his colleagues, to call him Subhuti. And that was in the 70s, so it's quite something. So something you said before, I think it's beautiful, it's interesting to hear, is how these groups were created. Because most of these processes and workshops were already created in Esalen and in the West and other growth centers in Europe. And then in Pune, they either were amended, modified, improved, slightly changed. I mean, Osho gave an input. So I'm yes. wondering how this process was handled. What was the the way the groups were created and Osho's relationship with the therapists?
Yeah. Already in the Bombay, Mumbai era, when he was living in the Woodlands apartment, I'm talking about 1970 to 1974, Osho was beginning to give some sort of little experiments to sannyasins who were there to do with each other. And these little experiments would mean like, I don't know, go tonight with to the apartment of, I don't know, Ma so-and-so, and talk to her for half an hour as if she was your mother. You know, things like this. You know, and then come back to me next day and report back to me how did that feel. I mean, you have to think it was also the time when Osho was creating his meditations. And nowadays, when people in, I don't know, in Osho International, and they say scientifically created meditations, many people laugh. These guys are using the word scientific for anything. And it's not. Osho was asking people to experiment with the faces of the meditations. So it was scientifically created. It wasn't like he came out one day and said, hey, I got this really groovy new meditation that I created all alone in my mind, and it's going to be a great benefit to all of you. No, he was experimenting. He would ask people to try this, to try that, and then report back to him. So it was really scientifically created. So he was giving little assignments of things that we could say had some sort of a therapeutic approach. Then when the ashram in Pune was creating in 1974, and all these therapists, famous therapists, came to him. We're talking about Paul Lowe, Patricia Lowe, Zulma Rayo. I think at the in 1975, I don't remember now the exact date, but in 1975, Ma Prem Divya, who had been personally trained, one of the first trainees of primal therapy with Arthur Janov. He had been living and working in Kaleidoscope Growth Center and Community, I think. He had been working in the basement doing primal therapy in London. Was there and had been with Osho since the time he was in Woodlands Apartments in Mumbai. And Osho asked her to create a 14-day primal therapy group. At this time, there were no primal therapy groups in the world. I mean, there was individual primal therapy in the line of what Janov had developed, but there were no primal therapy groups. And I remember Divya was telling me once that I felt I was betraying Janov because you were not supposed to do groups. This was individual work. So she was asked to create a 14-day therapy group. And then after that, the encounter group was created. So Tirtha, Paul Lowe, who Osho knew, he was trained with encounter and he was leading encounter groups in London, asked him to create a 7-day encounter group. And then intensive enlightenment came afterwards, what's called nowadays called Hu Zin. And then people started coming and Osho started giving them the possibility to lead different kinds of groups. At the beginning, this was thought, or let's say it was believed to be, I don't know, either a way of entertaining the people who were staying in Pune, you know, because they had like two meditations a day. Then Osho speaking in the morning and darshaning the evenings. And so what did you do the rest of the day? You know, hang out, you know, in the little chai stands. So in the beginning, it was thought, well, now we have groups. So we have something that we can entertain ourselves, or meanwhile, you know, between the meditation, so to speak. But then Osho was very clear, and he said that what he was encountering was that for Western people, it was very difficult to just sit in meditation. You know, it was very difficult to just go in because of all the unresolved issues that they were carrying them within themselves. So Osho said that he saw a place for humanistic psychology or for psychotherapy or for personal development within the realm of the expansion of consciousness. So it was like, what about that? Instead of trying to not identify with your emotional pain, why don't you go through it and see what happens? Why don't you devote 14 days to go through your childhood issues, your repressed emotion in relation to your own, you know, childhood trauma, and live it out? And then why don't you go and experiment with your ability to relate to people in the encounter group? Why don't you ask yourself questions that can take you beyond the mind, like in the intensive enlightenment? Or why don't you explore the issues with your couples in the couples group or the Tao group? Or why don't you explore your repressed emotions through your body, you know, in the pulsation groups, I think it was Anatta was called back then. So it was like meditation could also be approached through a way of working through your own things. So people would go from one group to another, and Osho would at that time usually be guiding you through what groups to take. And therapy or psychological work could be used as a step to going beyond the mind, or could be used as a step to taking distance from the content of the mind, especially for Western people, because Indians were not allowed into groups back then.
I think this is one of the most delicate points for me, as in my understanding and discussing with sannyasins, all the new, the relationship between therapy and meditation. And it's a very hot debate here, because Osho was, as you said, advising people as soon as they arrive in Pune, taking sannyas, and then he would say, you know, do this and that group. So he was encouraging and telling people to do this group. So there was like a feeling as if groups are really important, are part of the process. And then in my view, I've got a feeling that somehow some people think that with Osho, it's all about doing these therapy groups. So can you explore in your understanding, based on your research, what do you think about this process?
Well, I think the beautiful thing about Osho's work, it wasn't like a very clear path tested beforehand with a method that works in whatever context to get you to wake up. It wasn't like that. Osho, at the same time that was advising people to take the therapy groups in his ashram, was speaking against the therapy groups, you know? So it was all very confusing. And basically what happened, I think, is that what people usually would take, you know, whatever part of Osho's more than 35 years of speaking, they would take whatever fits your understanding of whatever. So the thing was that, like this, I mean, you with Osho, you never had a complete, clear-cut understanding of things. You never had a complete philosophy where you could explain the universe in terms of itself. You could never have a philosophy where you could find shelter from the perils of life, you know? Osho was contradicting himself all the time. So he was sending people to the therapy groups and then speaking against them. I remember, for instance, in Pune too, you know, we had Kavisha doing channeling session, being very successful with a lot of following, you know, and then in the evening, Osho speaking against channeling. I mean, and we're talking about something that was bringing a huge revenue to the ashram. And then Osho spoke against channeling that it was bullshit. You know, it was one of the biggest things happening at that time, you know, with people from the mystery school. So it was always like that. And I think that's the beauty of it, because my understanding, and this is my understanding, is that Osho was never interested in creating a comprehensive philosophy. What he was interesting was to take you to a point where you would question your own philosophy. And even if that philosophy, you got it from Osho himself, you know, he would question your inner structures. Whatever you think it's true is where you get stuck. When you say, okay, things are this way, when you come to a conclusion, you get stuck. So what he was doing was to creating a process where you would always be questioning everything in relation to where you were standing. And what happens is that years after he's gone, you take whatever part of these discourses suits you, and you say, okay, so Osho said this, and this fits with what I think. And then I hold it to my heart because my master said it. But if you read the next book, your master said completely different thing about the same subject. Now, what I think is that Osho saw a place in therapy in the realm of the expansion of consciousness. He never thought of it as an aim into itself. And he saw it way more disposable than meditation. And he saw therapy as a door to meditation. Of course, and this is my own experience too, I got to Osho through groups. And many people got to Osho through groups. And I still think there is a place for therapy in this process. And I think I am a psychotherapist myself, so I'm a bit biased, of course. But I think every meditator needs to take a look at himself from a therapeutic point of view. And every person who is involved in therapy needs to take a look at meditation, because eventually you need to learn to get beyond your mind. Because you can integrate, work through your traumas, work your emotions, work your relation, the issues with your mother. But the mind is a problem-creating machine. The mind is inbuilt to relate to life as a problem. So you will always find things to solve. So eventually you need to get to a point where you say, okay, what else is possible? And that what else is possible for me is meditation. You move away from the contents of your mind. You train yourself to take distance from the contents of your mind. So I think Osho took anything that had ever been developed, not only therapy, in the history of consciousness in the world, and put it in his ashram for you to experiment. So you had from Zazen to Vipassana, from Sufi dancing to encounter group, from Gestalt to Rolfing, to from rebalancing to acupuncture. You had everything you could have in the ashram at that time to experiment with yourself. So yeah. I think that was at least my understanding. Osho would take anything that would take you beyond yourself.
Yeah, sounds like it was such an open laboratory and experimentation in human consciousness, and he tried everything, every tool possible to help people. And yeah, I mean, what you said about all of us, I mean, at least me for sure, I pick those sentences of Osho that resonate with me. And I see this happening all the time. And we all kind of, Osho said this, Osho said that, you know? And but what sounds like it's this greatest paradox where with Osho is a path of trust and doubt at the same time.
Yeah, and it's funny because you can pick anything you want. You can make Osho says whatever you want, you know, because he spoke for 35 years, you know, and he spoke in different moments, and specifically, he spoke to different people. He wasn't philosophizing. He was talking to the people who were sitting in front of him. So, of course, people can, I've seen sannyasin throwing quotes back and forth like evangelicals, you know, trying to find what is the right Osho or the right way. And I think, then again, this is only my understanding, I think we missed the point there, because the right Osho is no Osho. I mean, I don't think Osho's way was about him. I think firmly that it was about waking up. He was a trick. He was a doorway. He was, as he used to say, the finger pointing to the moon. He was the method. The surrender to the master was not the aim, was the method. The aim is to wake up. And that waking up for me has to do with looking at the structure of your mind, how it wants to find absolute answers to hold on to, and have the courage to face life, but naked, you know, say, fuck, I don't know, you know, but I'm going to find out.
Yes, but let's go back to this discussion on therapy, and I'm curious to know and discuss a little bit about the relationship between Osho and the therapists at this time at Pune One, because I believe the relationship evolved through the time, and then we will come to Rajneeshpuram and Pune Two, etc. But staying at this first period, which is actually between 74 and 80, 81. So what was happening? What were the advices of Osho to the therapists on how they would conduct the groups? What was the feedback? And, you know, what was going on there?
Well, usually this, what would happen, I mean, it wasn't always like this, but it would be more or less like this. Osho would call one of the people who were there that he knew were therapists, and he would ask them if they would like to lead such and such group. And they say, of course, it was yes. If you said no, it wasn't so easy. So it would usually be yes, because that was the time of the surrender and the absolute yes. And then Osho would give a name to a group, usually. To some people, he would ask them, you know, what would you like to call your group? And so he would say, yes. And he would give a name to the group. And then he said, okay, so it's going to be a five-day group. And I would like you to work on this subject. So the person would go, developed whatever he thought. And sometimes they would communicate back to Osho. And Osho would like advise them back. And sometimes there was just no advice. And so Osho said, just lead this group. And that was it. And Osho would never interfere again. So Osho would have the list of the groups. And he would advise the participants, the sannyasins, or the visitors to go into such and such group. And usually in the middle of the group, you would have darshan with Osho. So the participants would have the chance to talk to Osho and also the therapist. And I think this is a very interesting thing, that the therapist would get advice from Osho. And you could see all through the darshan diaries that the therapists were basically in the same pace as the participants. It wasn't that the therapists were more advanced or more aware or superior. They were just the one who had the technical knowledge around whatever was being done. So the therapists would also expose themselves to Osho with their own insecurities and their doubts and their questions and their feeling of unworthiness, of not being good enough, or the group not working, or participants don't getting into the process. And so the interesting thing, I think, had to do with the fact that Osho was working not only with the participants, but he was working with the group leaders too. So if you were selected to lead a group, it wasn't because you had this beautiful, huge expertise and knowledge that you could share to the world, but it was because that was your path. That was your sadhana. That was your method. In the same way that he would advise meditations or groups to the participants, your being a group leader was part of your work on yourself, was part of your path. And in that sense, he would advise them to work with the people in such and such a way. But most of all, he would advise them about what it meant to be a group leader and how you had to become aware that you could use that as a way of hiding from yourself, you know, which I think it's really valuable, you know, that you could hide behind your role, behind this facade of I am the one who knows, I am the one who leads, or whatever. So it was beautiful. I mean, it was beautiful to see how he was using any situation and any possibility that he had to help people wake up about themselves. And I don't know, I remember Paul Lowe Tirthat telling me that Osho would advise him to be tougher on the participants of the encounter group, you know, not to allow them to run away from themselves. Or that he would advise, I don't know, Divya, who was leading the primal group, not to bring her own personal problems to the group. And this was very interesting because the advice that he would give to the therapist, it wasn't a technical advice in the sense of how to be a group leader, but it was advice that was in the direction of all their own growth. So he would say to Divya, for instance, don't bring your problems to the group. And he would tell, I don't know, Amitabh, for instance, or Rajen, to expose yourself emotionally in front of the participants. A completely different advice. So if you were, you know, at the back of Lao Tzu, you know, Chuang Te Zhu auditorium taking notes of how to be a group leader, you would go berserk. Because it wasn't, of course, later, all these things have been tried to systematize, especially in the trainings later in Pune too, you know, to create some sort of work where people go back to what Osho said and read it. But if you would take everything that Osho said to group leaders, you go berserk, because he was talking to the individuals. He would say to someone, be vulnerable with the participants, share everything you feel, expose yourself. And to the other one, he would say, be a plumber, be a technician. Just as the plumber goes to your house and fix your pipes, you don't know anything about the plumber. You don't talk to the plumber about your problems, and he doesn't talk to you about them. Be a plumber. So it was very interesting. And I think for the therapists, it was their path. It was their way. It was their sadhana. It was their meditation. It was their technique, was to be a group leader. And to be in that paradoxical position of being in what it certainly was, at least in the early 70s and 80s, a position of power, you know, because Osho was far away. You know, it was the same thing that in a certain way happened with Sheila in the ranch. You know, Osho was far away. So you had these sort of mini representatives, either were people from the management like Sheila or Lakshmi or Garim or Aruth then, or whether it was the group leaders, you know, who was like, wow, these are the channels, you know, Osho's working through them. People would project that onto them. But I think from Osho's point of view, it was very clear that was the work on themselves.
That's a very important point to highlight. And I think it's beautiful the way you put it. And also, again, it's based on your research, evidence. Perhaps just I would like a footnote. You mentioned many times the Darshan Diaries. For people who are listening who don't know what that is the transcripts of the discussion between Osho and the sannyasins, the people who had asked questions individually in intimate settings, including a lot of conversation with the therapist when he would advise them, as you said, what to do and which direction to take. And I think it's great to hear that to be a therapist in Osho's approach and Osho's view was a path of self-awareness for themselves. So it wasn't like a position of power, etc. And we'll pick up this again when we talk in part two of this interview during the time in Rajneeshpur and Pune 2, how things changed. And I'm aware that the relationship, some of the therapies kind of moved away. So we will get to that, into that, which it's interesting. Another topic I wanted to bring up and discuss with you is the use of psychedelic. Because in the early days of the human potential movement, psychedelic were used even before regulation and laws banned LSD, for example. When it was discovered, it was used in a clinical setting, in a therapeutic context. And the reason why I mention it and I want to bring it up is because it's not something that is over with the hippie times. There is a resurgence now of the use of psychedelic. So that's why I want to hear Osho's view on that. You know, there is a lot of talks nowadays on microdosing of LSD, even from CEO big companies in Silicon Valley, as well as a lot of ayahuasca ceremonies going on and happening. So I'd love to hear, based on your research, and again, there are different quotes of Osho saying different things at different times to different people, but let's get into it. And what's your understanding of Osho's view on the use of psychedelic for therapeutic uses?
Well, for most people in the late 60s, early 70s, the first experiences they had of no mind was through the use of LSD or mescaline or psychedelics. So for many people who end up in Pune, including the therapists, they had the first glimpses of something else beyond the constricted sense of self through the use of mind-expanding drugs. I think for many, many people, spiritual seekers at that time, that was the starting point. And then some people got hooked on them and decided, okay, this is going to be my path. I'm going to take one acid, you know, a week and get enlightened. And some people said, okay, so how can I reach this consciousness? How can I reach this awareness without depending or without the use of any chemicals? And these were two approaches. You know, Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert were the first ones who started to work in Harvard and with experimenting with the use of psychedelics. Stanislav Grof, the creator of holotropic breathwork, was also this Czech psychiatrist working with psychedelics and LSD in the treatment of his patients. And what was interesting at that time is that it was, we're talking about late 60s, early 70s, it was this boom of experimentation and finding out all the uses that could be taken from mind-expanding drugs. And then, of course, the prohibition came and this was banned. And that's when Stan Grof decided to develop holotropic breathing as a way of getting people to altered state of consciousness without using drugs. And people got into meditation with the idea of finding non-ordinary spaces of consciousness without the use of drugs. So I would say it would have been very, very rare someone who was spiritually minded and had never taken any expanding drug at that time. There were some people, you know, especially those who came through the Buddhist path that perhaps were not into that, but most of them had their first experiences around this with LSD or mescaline or peyote and all these that were being used. I mean, you have to understand around that time, late 60s, Carlos Castaneda's book came out, you know, Conversations with Don Juan. And, you know, and then everybody was like flooding the desert in the United States looking for Don Juan and the Indians that work with peyote. And then they found out that actually the Indians who worked with peyote were not these Indians, but there were other Indians. And well, later on, it was found out that all this was invented by Don Juan, which was actually something that Osho said early on. He said, this is fiction. At the time that everybody believed that the accounts of Carlos Castaneda were veridical anthropological research, you know, and Osho said, look, there are two kinds of spiritual fiction. First rate, Carlos Castaneda, and third rate, Lobsang Rampa, you know, but they're all fiction. It was funny because later on research was done and it was discovered actually that it wasn't true. He made it all up. Somebody find out where actually Carlos Castaneda was in the library researching the books where he got the ideas for whatever the conversation he had with Don Juan. So then these people came to Osho. There's a very early book. I think it's called LSD, the shortcut to false samadhi.
Well, the title already says it all, right?
Yes. So it's a conversation about acid between, you know, a visitor and Osho. And what Osho says, basically, LSD gives you a mirage, gives you a reflection of the actual state beyond the mind. It is like if you look at the moon reflected on water. That's the analogy that he used. This is like, yeah, you can get enchanted, but it's not the moon. It's just the moon reflected on water. So basically what he said, that yeah, mind-expanding drugs like LSD can give you a glimpse that something else is possible. But if it's valuable if you use it as a glimpse. He would use also another analogy where he would tell the story that in the Upanishad, there was mentioned some drug called Soma, you know, that people would take it in the early stage of disciplehood so that he could have a glimpse of what else was possible. But that the master would forbid the student to take Soma further because he would have to reach to that level of consciousness by himself. I have the feeling that that was basically the approach that he had all through, I would say, early 60s, I mean late 60s, early 70s, late 70s about drugs. The policy in the ashram in the 70s was you can't bring drugs into the ashram. Whatever you do with your private life outside is your problem. That was basically the ashram policy. I don't know. Now, of course, if you hear the accounts, lots of people were smoking dope most of the time or having hashish or taking an LSD, but that was none of Osho's problem. As long as you wouldn't do it inside the ashram, it was your private life. So I think that he saw a value in the possibility of having a glimpse of your potential, but he didn't see a value in it as a path. And actually, I would say he saw it as dangerous. If you want to take it as a path, you know, this is going to be my path. I'm going to be taking whatever drug I like or makes me feel good or gives me glimpses of whatever. Later on, he mentioned, I think it was at the end of the ranch or at the beginning of Pune too, I'm not quite sure, that the government should work on creating a drug that doesn't have side effects, that can give people a glimpse of a beautiful experience, can help them relax, that can help them expand their consciousness, but they should work on not having side effects, on not being a dangerous drug. And then, of course, after that, there was a huge, I think it was in Pune too, there was a huge discussions among sannyasins or what they had heard Osho saying, whether he was advocating the use of drugs or whether he was against the use of drugs. So this got to one of his secretaries, I think it was Ananda. And then they took the question to Osho, saying, okay, people are discussing and people are listening, are saying that you said this and these other people are saying that you said that. What did you actually say? And then Osho said something like, well, people like to use my words to support their own point of view. So they hear what they want to hear. What I said was, the drugs as they are, now they're dangerous and they're a hindrance in the path. But if they develop different drugs where there are no side effects, people could use them as a way of seeing what else is possible. So I don't think, and then I go to my own personal opinion, I don't think he advocated the extended use of psychedelics. That's what I would say.
Okay, now it's very clear, and it's pretty much what is my understanding based on what I've read from Osho, of course. I think there is new research on the use of psychedelic now, scientific research in the therapeutic yes. context. There is a resurgence not just for personal use, but also to use drugs to help people to continue that experiment, which started in the late 60s and then was kind of cut off by legislators, by prohibition.
And I think they had pretty good results. If you look at the research that they did in the late 60s, it was working. I mean, Stan Grof was working with patients that were basically alcoholics. And after one session with the LSD, you know, it would be over. Of course, that I was reading recently about some research that's been done with mushrooms, you know, with psychedelic mushrooms. And the microdosing of psychedelic mushrooms for people who had profound depression. And they have found something that I think, if it's true, it's very interesting, because most of what we call behavior basically means is a wiring of neurons that fire together, which is called a neural pathway. And we know, the people who work in this area, that you cannot disrupt that. You can create new ones if you want to change a behavior, basically, a change of behavior pattern. You create a new pathway for the bioelectrical impulse to travel, but you cannot destroy the old ones. That's why if you don't keep on working on yourself and actualizing yourself, you're going to be drawn to the old patterns. And I was reading about some research that there's some sort of psychedelic mushroom that actually can disrupt old neural pathways, which would be very interesting if it was true, but I don't know.
Yeah, let's see. But I think based on what we're discussing here is that the use of psychedelic within a therapeutic context has a place, can be very helpful for people in a certain settings. For a spiritual path can be also helpful to give a glimpse, but clearly Osho, on one hand, never condemned because it's not his approach and style, but also never openly advocated the use of psychedelic as a path to spiritual growth and enlightenment.
And I think the main issue here is whether you take it as an experience or whether you take it as a path. As a path, he saw it as a hindrance. As an experience, he was unsure, why not? But try meditation. You can actually see the real moon, not the reflection on the water.
Go for the real deal.
Go for the real deal, man. And actually, I remember that there was a time when the ecstasy drug came out. And Osho at some point said, they use the word ecstasy for this drug. And ecstasy is copyrighted by my people.
Absolutely.
I think it was at the end of the ranch, he said that.
Beautiful, beautiful. Okay, that's the end of the part one. I think we discussed at length the context of Puna One, and I'd love to pick it up in part two and discuss and carry on the same topic, but during the time of Rajneeshpuram and Puna Two, and also I'd love to discuss present day and the legacy of Osho and a little bit about your work and what you do. So, yeah, thank you so much for your time and for being part of the Osho podcast. And you shared a lot of value, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you. It's been really fun to be here talking to you. And delighted to talk again whenever you think it's appropriate.
Amazing. Okay. Look forward to the next part.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it and leave a review. Visit loveosho.com for more episodes, blogs, or to connect with us.